British film director John Schlesinger made his first American movie in 1969 and won Academy Awards for Best Director and Best Film. The film was Midnight Cowboy with Dustin Hoffman and John Voight. Since then, Schlesinger has divided his time between England and the United States. He's been making movies since 1961. They include Billy Liar, Darling, Sunday Bloody Sunday, Marathon Man, The Falcon and the Snowman, and The Believers. Schlesinger first learned about movie making by acting and making documentaries for British television. His latest film, Madame Suzatska, has just been released on video. It stars Shirley MacLaine as a Russian-American piano teacher living in London. Suzatska takes on young students with the potential for greatness and teaches them about life as well as music. She's strong-willed, temperamental, and jealous of other influences on her students. But under her guidance, several students have become brilliant pianists. Her new student is a 15-year-old boy of Indian heritage. In this scene, Madame Suzatska meets with the boy's mother.
No. I can take your son on Tuesdays and Thursdays. No, Tuesdays and Fridays.
Oh, but he helps me on Fridays. It's a very busy day for me with the weekend orders.
Mrs. Sen, whenever I take on a new student, I give myself and my time totally and freely. It is an absolute commitment for both of us, the student and myself, because, you see, I teach not only how to play the piano, but how to live. You'll be very proud of your son. Now there are two of us to care.
John Schlesinger, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You've always said that you're more interested in themes relating to failure than success, and I wonder how that applies to your new film, Madame Suzatska.
Well, I think actually it's about people that have to deal with both. The problems of being successful and the problems of having been a failure. Which we all, every artist, I think, suffers or has to endure during his lifetime. And how do you deal with both and keep going and surmount all obstacles, I think, is one of the themes of this film, and certainly one of the important things of one's life.
I guess it's something you've had to deal with
Absolutely.
Your film, success and failure.
Absolutely. All my life.
This is the first film role Shirley MacLaine has taken since Terms of Endearment, and I was wondering how you cast her in it.
Well, I'd admired her very much over the years, but particularly in Terms of Endearment, where I thought she'd shown extraordinary kind of courage in playing that role and appearing in all kinds of ages and conditions. And I needed a very courageous actress. Originally, we weren't looking for an American. It was written for a Russian, for a European, certainly. And when we decided to ask Shirley, who was my first choice in the States, I, for some reason, hadn't expected her to be as enthusiastic about the role in the film as she was. But she made an instant kind of identification with the part and excitement for the film and made a commitment which has been quite wonderful.
Shirley MacLaine and the young Indian actor who plays her student are both not musicians. What is it like to work with actors who aren't musicians but are playing pianists?
Make sure you've got a very good musician who understands the problems of an actor having to play a musician who is quite brilliant. I mean, Shirley, after all, is musical. I mean, she's been brought up in the musical theatre and she was a dancer. So her background is certainly a musical one, and she understood all that and has indeed played a bit of piano in her time. Naveen Chowdhury, who plays opposite her as Manik in the film, the young, brilliant 15-year-old student of the piano, had never played a note of music in his life. I think he plays drums.
It must have been fun to hear this actor play when he was just hitting any note, but making it look right.
We silenced the piano as quickly as we could, because
really
did sound awful. So from the very word go, he was always playing to playback or to a disc of some kind.
I want to get back to this idea that you've, in many of your films, been more interested in failure than success. You know, when Rocky came along, Hollywood, anyways, got very success-oriented in its movies. Was that a bad turn for you?
No, because when you use failure rather too heavily, I think. I mean, in a sense, Midnight Cowboy was about two failures, but they won, in a sense, the end, because they'd learned something through their relationship and so forth. And even though he was dying, Ratso Rizzo did make it to Miami. and died there. So in my view, that's not total failure. I think what I mean by being more interested in failure is trying to cope with it in making the necessary compromises to that. If it was about success only, that would be too obvious for my taste. I mean, I think that it's the negative things that one has to deal with in life, make compromises over, make adjustments to, win against, that really interests me. It's the problems that failure throws up, I suppose.
I'd like to talk with you about some of your best-known films, and since we've already brought up Midnight Cowboy, why don't we start with that? This was the first film that you made in the United States.
Yes.
And John Voight stars as someone from the South, right? I forget if it's from
Texas.
The South or the Midwest. From Texas,
Texas,
yeah. Who moves to New York, and he thinks he's going to become this great stud, but instead of hustling other people, everybody else basically hustles him. And one of the people who he meets is Ratso Rizzo, played by Dustin Hoffman. And I'd like to play the bar scene in which these two characters meet. And the part of the scene that we're playing opens with John Voight being kind of propositioned by a transvestite.
Hi, cowboy. Got a cigarette?
Hey, sweetheart.
More damn faggots in this town.
Oh, kiss it, Ratso.
Up yours. You gotta watch out for that.
Hey, you really know the ropes.
Oh, damn, I wish I bumped into you before.
Huh.
I'm Joe Buck from Texas.
Enrico Rizzo from the Bronx.
And I'm gonna buy you a drink. What the hell do you think of that?
Well, I don't mind if I do.
Bartender, drinks all around. One for my friend here, too.
Damn, I know when I give satisfaction, I give her satisfaction. I mean, you see what I'm getting at here? She got a penthouse up there with a color TV, more diamonds than an archbishop.
And she busts out bawling when I ask her for money.
For what?
For money.
Wait a minute. For money for what?
Oh, hell, I'm a hustler. You didn't know that?
Now, how am I supposed to know that? I mean, you got to tell a person these things.
I'm a hustler.
It's a scene from Midnight Cowboy. Now, this is the story of someone who comes from Texas to New York and really doesn't know his way around and makes a lot of mistakes while learning the ropes. This was your first film in America. Did you empathize at all since you were new to the country yourself?
Totally. I mean, that was the reason I thought I could make the film, because in a sense, New York is a fantasy for the cowboy. And he thinks, he imagines it as one thing, and then the reality turns out to be something quite different. And I suppose in a way I could empathize with that. And most of the films that I've made in the States have in some way been about fantasy or fantasists. And I felt that that was something I really could relate to.
You worked with Dustin Hoffman in this film before he really became a star. I think you actually cast him before The Graduate came out.
No, The Graduate was already out, and I didn't believe that he was a character actor until I actually met him, dressed for the role. He came to meet me in New York, and we walked around 42nd Street, and he was wearing a dirty old raincoat, and kind of melded in so perfectly with the background that he got the part by the end of the evening. And all I'd got to go on was the reputation as a character actor and having seen him in The Graduate playing a very different kind of role.
When he was walking around in that raincoat, was that something he was doing to prove to you how good a character actor he could be, or is that just the way he was dressed?
No, he was trying to prove.
Oh, okay,
he was trying to
checking.
Get the part, I reckon, yes.
I think when this movie came out, it was X-rated.
Yes.
Initially?
Yes, it was.
It seems pretty tame by today's standards. I mean, there's four-letter words in it and some nudity, but it's still... You think it would have gotten an X today?
No. It very quickly lost its X, in fact.
Oh.
After the Oscars.
Did you fight for that, or did you just...
No, at the time, I think Jerry Hellman, the producer, and I both felt, you know, okay, that's probably what it should get. It was the X rating then meant something quite different to the rating now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when it got an R rating, they'd already changed the meanings of what X rating represented.
Midnight Cowboy was your first film in the United States. Why did you want to make an American film?
Oh, I thought the book was extraordinary, and it would give me an opportunity to deal with an American theme. I hadn't until I read the book, I'd had no ambition actually to come here to work. And when I read it, I thought, this is a hell of a story, and I understand these two characters, even though I don't know them, really. And I came to America on the heels of a tremendous failure, Far From the Madding Crowd, which was a quite tough baptism of fire. And I stayed on in Los Angeles after it had opened there and flopped rather badly, working on the screenplay of Midnight Cowboy with Waldo Salt, and hung around, you know, Hollywood Boulevard, which is a fairly sleazy area. And some of the things in the film I saw and experienced on the boulevard, and then came to New York. And with Waldo, we trudged the streets of New York, experiencing more things, all of which have a place in the movie. And it was a very interesting period of my life, because I came to the States to promote a film which hadn't worked. So I knew what rejection in Hollywood terms meant and how. And then started to work on this next movie and really got more and more hooked and intrigued by the whole subject.
Well, Midnight Cowboy was made in 1969. Let me ask you about a film you made a couple of years later in England, Sunday Bloody Sunday.
And yes.
This film starred Glenda Jackson and Peter Finch as two people both in love with the same man, a bisexual man. Was it hard to get backing to do this movie? It was not a moralistic film that preached against homosexuality.
No, it certainly wasn't. No, it was, and funnily enough, though the subject was tough, I suppose, the fact that Midnight Cowboy was so successful enabled me to get backing fairly quickly from United Artists, who'd also distributed Midnight Cowboy. And they, I remember the remark of David Picker, who was running the company, head of production at that time, "I don't quite know where this script is taking us, but if you want to do it, do it. It's not going to cost too much." And we did.
There's a scene where Peter Finch and Murray Head, the actor who plays the bisexual man, kiss. And it was really a very brave scene for the time, for 1971.
Yes, that was ahead of its time.
Did you have to fight to include that?
No, I didn't have to fight to include it. I mean, some very strange things happened. I mean, the actors didn't object to doing it because they realised that it was quite important. And I felt it had to be treated just as an everyday occurrence. I mean, Penelope Gilliard, who wrote the screenplay, and I had some quite serious arguments about the scene, because she felt it should be kind of done in long shot and silhouette, and in a sense made a special deal of by trying to throw it away. And I felt it should just happen in front of the camera with no big deal as part of their everyday behaviour in private. And that's the way we did it. And there were objections, certainly, in the cinema. I remember one of the first screenings in America, a woman nudged her husband in front of me and said, "Come on, Harry, let's get out. This is not a film for nice people." And Peter Finch's wife could never quite get used to it when she came to the opening at Venice Festival. I remember she screamed out loud when the kiss happened. And I said before the London premiere, "Now, please, just keep your trap shut. You know it's coming. Shut up." But she couldn't resist screaming again. So I was very glad when she wasn't on the road with us in America.
It's really funny. She'd probably seen her husband getting killed in movies.
Yes,
but didn't get this kind of reaction.
No, this was more horrendous to her, I guess. Anyway, it was a film that I think was probably ahead of its time, and I don't think that the United Artists expected it to have the kind of critical success it did, and I'm very glad that it got the attention it did. And by some strange trick of fate now, in London, in England, there's a new law, Clause 28, which has just been passed, which forbids any local authority to back anything that encourages or is seen to promote the cause of homosexuality.
So are you saying that you think you wouldn't have been able to make that scene?
No, now I'm saying this film, mm-hmm. 20 years after the event, could not be included in any kind of special festival of films financed by a local government body, as it would be seen to promote the cause of homosexuality, thus putting us back to over 20 years in censorship. It's quite ludicrous, and we're all fighting it.
How are you fighting it?
by a great deal of protest. It is law now, and they say it's not intended to, you know, ban the works of Oscar Wilde in the local public library or so on and so forth. But I think that it could play into the hands of the really bigoted, of which there are plenty about.
It must be very disturbing to feel that things are going backwards.
Yes, very, indeed. I think it's a state of affairs which has been brought on by a number of things, including the paranoia and the lack of understanding and the fear of AIDS, I guess.
Let me ask you about the film Marathon Man. You made this in 1976. It also starred Dustin Hoffman. As a graduate student who unwittingly becomes involved in international espionage, now the most talked about scene in this movie is the dental torture scene in which Dustin Hoffman is tortured by Laurence Olivier. Olivier plays a Nazi doctor who uses his dentistry as a technique to extract information from people under torture. I want to just play this scene and then talk with you about making it. So this is Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, please don't worry. I'm not going into that cavity. That nerve's already dying. A live, freshly cut nerve is infinitely more sensitive.
So, I'll just drill into a healthy tooth until I reach the pulp. Unless, of course, you can tell me that it's safe. Nothing. If it known, he would have told. Get rid of him.
Not very pretty, is it?
It's worse on sound than it is in vision, in fact.
No, it's more like the real thing where you have your eyes clenched shut and you're just hearing the sounds of the drill.
Yes, you never ever see it in the film. You never see drill on tooth. It's all suggested by eyes and by the drill coming towards the camera.
Well, civilians never really do see what that looks like. Only dentists get to see that.
No, but I mean, the audience never see it.
Right, but I mean, it's more like the way you experience
it. Yes, absolutely.
Because you don't see the drill hitting your teeth when you're in the dentist's office.
No, but you see it coming towards your mouth. And that scene, I mean, had everybody squirming. It was in the book, Bill Goldman's book, and I thought it was a terrific scene. But we had to do it very artfully. Though I knew that it was literally a nerve that would hit, when hit, would affect everyone. Certainly me. Because I think very often you put things into films which affect you one way and another. Certainly things that terrify you. And the dentist, going to the dentist, always terrified me. So it was a scene that I felt very, very strongly identification with.
Did you want to make the scene as horrible as possible, or did you want to keep it medium horrible?
I wanted to make it feel, but I didn't want it to be gloating over the violence of it, which is why we never showed anything graphic. It was all suggested. And the first moment that you hear the whir of the motor of the drill, you don't even see it. It's behind the lid of a suitcase, which is opened. I always think that everything is better suggested and leave the rest to the audience imagination, where possible.
It wouldn't surprise me if there was more than once when you were in the dentist chair and your dentist, before undoing the drill, gave you his impressions or her impressions of the scene. Has that happened to you?
Well, I must confess that since the film, I've been probably more scared of going to the dentist for fear that they'd get revenge. But I know my dentist quite well. And funnily enough, dentists that I've been to have always rather enjoyed the film. So they haven't tortured me too badly.
Well, good. Another film I want to ask you about, The Falcon and the Snowman, made in 1984. It starred Timothy Hutton and Sean Penn as Christopher Boyce and Andrew Lee. Was that the other person's name?
Dalton Lee.
Dalton,
yes.
Lee, yeah. Yes. And this is based on the true story of two young upper-middle-class men who sold secrets to the Soviets.
Yeah.
Very good performances in this. I want to play an excerpt of a scene where Timothy Hutton and Sean Penn are at the airport, and Penn has also been dealing drugs, and he's been getting high and hooked on his own drugs, and it's made him very paranoid, and he thinks that Timothy Hutton is going to turn on him and betray him.
Yes.
I'm not stupid, Chris. I read books.
What are you talking about?
I know what it's called. Disinformation. Counter-espionage.
What?
You're backed by the company.
Oh, Jesus.
You're one of them. The CIA has got a picture of Oswald, and they've got one of me, too, and that's all part of the plan. So it's okay. It's okay. So what happens next? You throw me in the walls? You throw me in the walls?
Look at that. It's doing to you.
It's the only thing keeping me safe.
It's killing you.
It's the only thing keeping me safe. I don't know who my friends are anymore. I don't know who to trust. I don't know who to trust. Don't throw me to the walls.
Now, listen, you leave your bags behind. We're going to get on the plane and get out of here. We'll go home.
It's a very interesting performance from Sean Penn, yeah. In part because he's always seen as being an homosex symbol, and in this movie he's such a flake.
Yeah.
He's so out of control and out of control of his mind and
yeah.
and
such
and
a
his actions.
Fantasist. That's again, it's the element of fantasy which attracted me to the character.
How did you tune up the performance with him and decide even that whiny voice that he uses throughout so much of the movie?
Well, it happened, I think, it evolved during rehearsal. Both Timothy Hutton and to a certain extent, Sean Penn, met the protagonists they were playing in jail. They visited them. Timothy Hutton had quite a long and close relationship, as close as it could ever get, over the telephone and occasional visits with Chris Boyce himself.
Chris Boyce was the real spy that this is based on.
Yes, and
did you approve of that? Of them going to jail and visiting people?
I mean, I let them do it. I couldn't stand in their way. The only thing that there is always a problem about, reenacting a real person that exists, because there's always other bits of information you get which the actor playing the part thinks is vital. Oh, my goodness, that happened. We must show that. We must show this. And that can complicate, a screenplay which is fairly tight. And there were times when we had to alter things, or felt it right to alter things, from information that we'd got from the real people in life through the actors. But I thought that the scene you just played was going to be one of the most difficult to shoot, and it didn't turn out to be. I think that Sean Penn had prepared for it very well and knew what the high was like, had experienced it before, and played it. We did very few takes. We shot it in the airport at Mexico City, and I thought we would have to sort of gear up to it many times and would want to build a set in the studio, but we couldn't afford to do that, so we went out to do it on location in the airport, and it actually worked terribly well and very quickly.
That's a very good scene. You entered the film industry in England right after the Second World War. What kind of state was the movie industry in when you...
Well, I tried to get into it after the Second World War. I made when I was a student, a sort of amateur student film about a hanging in the 17th century that had actually taken place on a hill near where my family lived. And it got some attention. It was just a student film. Then I became a professional actor, so I didn't go into the film industry immediately, because, as usual, there was a slump, as there always seemed to be permanently slumps in different countries' film industry, and there certainly is often in England. And I tried, having made this student film, to get a job as a T-boy or an assistant, and couldn't. So I became a professional actor for some years, made a small documentary about Hyde Park, which got shown by BBC Television, and eventually got in through television, making small documentaries for magazine programs. And that got me my break, finally.
What about working with actors? Do you have a certain style in working with them? Do you like to let them bring what they want to a performance, or do you try to pretty strictly guide what they do?
Well, I have very strong visual images of what I want to do with the film before I start shooting. And within those parameters, I feel that the actors must be given freedom to express themselves as much as they can. I mean, I think they've got a great deal to add to a film. If I respect the actors, there are some actors that are very selfish and need hitting hard, and some that are very inexperienced and frightened and need help. But the majority of them, I've found, are people that you're collaborating with in a spirit of of very sort of warm creation, in a sense. You've got to give them space to feel free, to make fools of themselves if necessary. And then you are there to hold them down and to tell them where to taper down a performance. Because acting for the movies isn't really acting, it's being a character. And as long as I feel I'm trusted and I trust them, then I think there's an extremely fruitful atmosphere for collaboration.
Do you think that having acted before you started directing has made you more sensitive to the actors that you work with?
I think I know what their problems are when they come on the set and everybody's hanging around and there's pressure, which there always is, to get a performance as quickly as possible. And I admire good screen acting tremendously. I mean, there are certain favourite actors I have who, like Peter Finch had and Alan Bates has, which is the quality of conceal. There's more there, and it doesn't all show itself at once. Some actors, you see the performance, and they can be very good actors and very good performances, but you don't feel there's a reserve, greater emotional reserve underneath, which the best screen actors, I think, have. Monty Clift had it in spades.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your directing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.